This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. It's great to have you with us. Some public school advocates are sounding alarms over several issues in Governor Walker's proposed biennial budget. They point to essentially unchanged state aid and a call for expanding the state's voucher program as new challenges to Wisconsin's public school systems. Some also say that the effort to reward higher-performing schools would come at the expense of schools already facing a steep climb in districts such as Milwaukee Public Schools. But the author of a new book points out that challenges to MPS are nothing new. Barbara Miner's book is called Lessons from the Heartland, A Turbulent Half-Century of Public Education in an Iconic American City. Miner tells Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke why she believes these local chapters of history have national relevance.
Well, as people know, Milwaukee and the Heartland were often seen as middle America, just as Wisconsin was a sort of bellwether for the presidential election. That's one very important reason. Another really important reason is Milwaukee has the country's oldest and still the largest school, private school voucher program. So we are, in some ways, for districts around the country, we could be your future.
Would you say that other cities and states look to Milwaukee as a laboratory?
Well, certainly the Bradley Foundation, which were some of the biggest and earliest funders of the school voucher movement, clearly saw Wisconsin and Milwaukee as a laboratory, both from vouchers and welfare. And as our current governor hopes, we will be a laboratory for his policies in 2016.
Well, so vouchers are part of the more recent history of issues surrounding Milwaukee public schools. Let's turn the clock further back because this book covers a full 50 years. Why was 50 years the appropriate point? Was there a period you could point to and say things were okay until this point? Or is that a false dichotomy?
That's a very good question because when I was writing with the book and I did a lot of thinking before I even put a word down. And the issue was how to explain where we are today. And I grew up in Milwaukee, so some of it was I remember the 1950s. And I can't remember, it was probably during one of my walks along the Milwaukee River, it suddenly struck me, 1957, the Milwaukee Braves win the World Series. Even Hank Aaron said, life doesn't get much better than Milwaukee in 1957. And for a lot of people, that was our day.
The Braves World Series victory aside, this was also the period where manufacturing was running at its post-war
Milwaukee
high.
Milwaukee was on top of the world economically. When you go back to some of those economic statistics, even within these sort of racial dichotomies that have always affected the city, we had some of the best employment, the best family-supporting jobs. One of the reasons Milwaukee had the later great migration of African Americans south from the south to the north is because we had such a vibrant economy in the 1950s. We were, in many ways, the promised land.
Well, so what did that mean for the education system here?
Well, it meant different things for different people. I mean, clearly, in the 1950s, the hallmark of education, both in the south and the north, was segregation. But within that, there was a clear and strong public support for public schools. And we had that sin and that stain of the segregation. But there were any number of different going to the voters to increase funding for the schools, and they passed. And it was a time of expansion, both for the city and for the schools. And life was good, and there was a strong support for the public sector, not just the schools, but our parks.
Did that mean equal access to quality education? What was the state of public education in the more predominantly African American parts of town, given how historically segregated the city was?
Right. Well, you know, I grew up in Milwaukee, and the term we used in the 1950s, and when I mentioned this to my friends around the country, they look at me, but we called it the inner core. We didn't call it the ghetto; it was the core. And you know, clearly, At the beginning of the 1950s, the Milwaukee African-American population was actually still fairly small, but it was relegated to living in that core. And at that era, whether you were a doctor or whether you were a domestic servant, you lived in the core.
Well, and so to get back to what were schools like in the core?
Well, there was indeed – there were separate and unequal schools. And that was part of what happened in terms of Milwaukee, the freedom schools in the 1960s. You know, Milwaukee oftentimes is a little bit behind the times. So, you know, the desegregation, the Supreme Court, Brown v. Board came down in 1954. But it wasn't really until the early 1960s that the Milwaukee school desegregation movement really, really started in earnest. And in particular, a boycott in 1964 called Freedom Schools.
Well, so let's talk about what that was. So Freedom Schools are probably familiar to people who have lived here for a long time. But what was that phenomenon all about?
Well, what it was in 1964, the 10th year anniversary of Brown v. Board, the people, the African-American community and their supporters in the white community wanted to call attention to the segregation in the Milwaukee public schools, which the powers that be said, well, you know, it's not our fault that the schools are segregated. Housing is segregated, which is an interesting argument because you hear it even today. And in order to call attention to the school segregation, they had a one-day boycott called Freedom Schools. And about 15,000 kids boycotted the schools and went to these freedom schools that were in churches, a lot of Central City churches, and they had strong support among the religious community, in the African-American community, although it wasn't without controversy. Some people said, well, it's mere truancy. But it was a very strong statement by the black community that enough was enough and that there had to be an end to segregated schooling.
Well, so what was the legacy of that that one individual boycott?
Well, that individual boycott, needless to say, of course, it didn't end segregated schools. In fact, Milwaukee's desegregation, the court order didn't come down until 1976. But it kicked off an era of several years before the open housing protests when school segregation really was the civil rights movement in Milwaukee. And there were any number of protests against a phenomenon called intact busing.
Well, and so describe that phenomenon.
Yes, I know, because if you're not from Milwaukee and you don't know about intact busing, it almost seems too surreal to be true. A lot of the schools in the black community were older. They were overcrowded because by this point there was a growing African-American community. And the school board, as official policy, started a program called Intact Busing in which they would bus black kids while the schools were being renovated or because of overcrowding to predominantly white schools, maybe 1 mile, maybe 3 miles. But they would literally take the kids intact in a bus, the black kids, to a white school. What black kids would arrive after the white kids were in class, would go to separate classrooms. Oftentimes they were bused back to their original school for lunch because they didn't want the whites and blacks interacting at lunch, and even the recesses were segregated. So it was a way of busing to ensure that there was absolutely no interaction between the black and white students.
And how long did the intact busing as a phenomenon exist?
Well, as official policy, I think it was into the 1970s. It was well over a decade. And so there were many protests. In fact, people may not realize it, but Father Grappi's first arrest as a Catholic priest was during a protest against school segregation and specifically against the intact busing.
When did the legal system really first become involved in school integration in Milwaukee?
Well, Lloyd Barbie, who is the lawyer most associated with the school desegregation lawsuit, he filed his suit, I believe it was 1965. It wasn't until 1976 that the federal courts declared Milwaukee's public schools unconstitutionally segregated. It was a long, long protracted court case. Interesting, the Supreme Court decision, I think it was about 3 years from the time the suit was first filed and the U.S. Supreme Court issued its decision. So for a lot of different reasons, it just went on and on and on in the courts.
Well, and what it seemed to generate was, at first, a policy of voluntary desegregation?
Well, there was the first court order came down in January 1976, and it was by next September, you have to start desegregating. And that was like, oh my gosh. And the historical context, and this is what was fascinating about doing the research for the book, you realize how much of Milwaukee is related to national events, and vice versa, how much Milwaukee in turn will also influence national events. And what I hadn't realized was the Milwaukee desegregation in 1976 was right around the time of the Boston busing protests. And if Little Rock was the symbol of Southern opposition to desegregated schools, Boston clearly was the symbol of Northern resistance. And it was ugly. It was just out and out ugly. Whites throwing stones, you know, hackling kids and violence. I mean, it was a national shame. And so when that federal court decision came down in Milwaukee, there was this huge sentiment in Milwaukee. We are not going to be a Boston. We have order in Milwaukee. So their way to get around this was basically to not ask too much of the white community and to ask them to voluntarily go to integrated schools.
And how did that work?
Boy, how did that work? Well, that's a whole nother book, Mitch. How did desegregation in Milwaukee work? And, you know, that's not an easy answer. One of the things I learned in doing the book that I hadn't realized was that just as Milwaukee was trying to desegregate its schools, which was clearly the most complicated transformation ever of the city's public education, that's when deindustrialization hit and the city's economy fell apart. And when deindustrialization hit, no institution in Milwaukee was immune. Families, neighborhoods, jobs, schools. And I hadn't quite realized the impact of deindustrialization on what happened and how it affected desegregation in Milwaukee.
Well, and you anticipated my next question, because the question I wonder is, had the manufacturing industry remained healthy into the early 1980s and in the decade that followed, would desegregation have looked greatly different?
Well, you know, Mitch, if I do another book, maybe I'll do an alternate history book, because it is a fascinating question, because the deindustrialization above all devastated the black community in Milwaukee, because you had a route to the middle class, you know, family supporting jobs, and people were beginning to buy homes. And one of the differences between Milwaukee, say, and Chicago is because Chicago's migration was much sooner. By the time deindustrialization hit, there was a well-established black middle class in Chicago, not so in Milwaukee. So people who were just – and families that were just barely getting onto their feet were completely knocked down.
Do you think it's – is it important to understand this stuff before deindustrialization happened to understand where we are today, or is really the most relevant part of the discussion about where Milwaukee public schools are today and education in this city, is it really the what's happened since deindustrialization that we should be studying?
I don't think there's any way to understand anything going on in Milwaukee without understanding some of the history, and the history that goes back certainly to World War II, you know, because that was a whole different era. You know, going back to the 1890s, well, you know, maybe we could go back that far. But clearly the long history of tenuous and tense relationships between the black and white community, that's been going on forever, but certainly since World War II, when the black community started growing in the city. You know, the whole issue of public support for public schools and public institutions and what happens when the economy is in a free fall, and not only in a free fall, but there's a different ethos where – and this is one of the things that I found interesting in looking at the broader picture in Milwaukee. It's not that the Milwaukee region is poor. I mean, there's some really strong economic growth. You know, certainly the Great Recession of the last couple of years has changed things. But, you know, there's been suburban areas in Milwaukee where there's – the poverty is rather minimal compared to the country as a whole, to say nothing of Wisconsin. So what we have here is growing disparity. And certainly it's along lines of race, but not just along lines of race. So, you know, how do we deal with growing disparity? That's a huge issue we face.
And that is an issue for another interview.
Boy. That's why I wrote a history book, because to try and figure out every answer for the future is pretty difficult.
Well, thanks for helping us outline the questions anyway. Barbara Miner, thanks so much.
Oh, thank you, Mitch.
Barbara Miner is a writer in Milwaukee and the former managing editor of the magazine Rethinking Schools. Her new book is Lessons from the Heartland, a turbulent half-century of public education in an iconic American city. It's published by the New Press. She spoke with Mitch Tyke, and you'll find links to more information at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. The word fusion is usually paired with cuisine or music, but when we come back, we'll learn about a law enforcement fusion taking place right here in Milwaukee. Stay tuned for more of Lake Effect on WUWM right after this.